Europe is experiencing the largest wave of refugees since World War II and is desperate to find a long-term solution. Join America Abroad for a town hall discussion linking New York to Berlin on iTunes and PRI.org/America Abroad.
Russia in mourning today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Officials in Moscow are investigating why a Russian airliner crashed in Egypt this weekend. Meanwhile, Russians themselves are in shock.
It's the worst airline tragedy in Russian history. And you know, also a lot of Russians travel to Egypt every year.
Also in Turkey, voters hand a stunning victory to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Erdogan made a number of gambles, risking really huge things, including the security of the country, and he appears to have won big.
Plus, Harry the Rhino flies all the way from Cincinnati to Sumatra just to meet the ladies.
Yeah, so in terms of the Rhino dating game, he's got some good chances over there in Sumatra.
Those stories are coming up today on The World.
The World is brought to you by Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. There is no clear indication yet as to why a Russian airliner crashed this weekend in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. The flight was operated by Metrojet, a Russian carrier. It was on its way from the Egyptian resort of Sharm el-Sheikh to St. Petersburg. All 224 people on board died. Islamic State militants claimed responsibility for bringing the jet down. Those claims were initially rejected by Russian authorities, but today the company which owns the plane said the only reasonable explanation is that it was due to external influence. My BBC colleague Rafael Sakov has been following the story from Moscow, and he told me Russians are taking the news very hard.
Everybody is in grief in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, other Russian cities, because it's a really big tragedy. People are shocked. It's the worst airline tragedy in Russian history. 224 people killed. The previous death toll was 170 people in 2006. And you know, also a lot of Russians travel to Egypt every year. About 3 million Russians go there, and mostly to Sharm el-Sheikh resort city, which is also really, really popular among Russians.
How are the Russian media handling this disaster? What have you seen on TV?
You know, of course, mostly Russian media here, they are under government control, so they are state-controlled media. They give information that they cannot rule out that terrorists could have had a hand in the air disaster. But as we know today, it was Kagalim Avia, this company which is operating under the brand Metrojet. They gave a press conference and they told that the jet could have been torn apart, broke apart, only if there was something physical or something mechanical influence on the aircraft.
Tell me a bit more about Metrojet. How new is this airline? Do they kind of dabble in cheap seats to these resorts?
They are working on mostly almost 20 years, this company, but they are a small company. Yesterday, they were instructed by the Russian watchdog, transport watchdog, to ground all other their jets because they don't know still what was the reason of this tragedy, of this crash, and until it will be investigated, they should ground all their other jets.
Let's get back to where these holidaymakers were visiting. It's, as we said, Egypt's Sharm el-Sheikh Resort. Why is that destination popular with Russian tourists?
First of all, because you know that in Russia it's almost always cold, not of course in summer, but in autumn, spring, they are always cold seasons in Russia. I'm not speaking about winter as well. It's terrible. So of course a lot of Russian people go somewhere to warm cities, countries, and also it's the beginning of the season in Egypt in October, so it's now really good weather there, so that's why people go to Egypt and they like it. And also the relations between Russia and Egypt were always very good, and they feel comfortable in Egypt.
Does this go back to Soviet times? Were Soviet citizens going to Sharm el-Sheikh during the Cold War?
I think no, because that time almost no Russians were leaving the country. So, of course, it's difficult to compare because now it's, of course, open tourism. You can travel where you want, not like it was earlier in Soviet time.
That was my colleague, the BBC's Rafael Sakov in Moscow. For Egypt and its tourism industry, the crash could not have come at a worse time. In fact, representatives from more than 40 Egyptian hotels and travel agencies are in London today to promote their country's attractions at the World Travel Show. The crash of the Russian aircraft is not making it an easy pitch. Laura Dean is a senior Middle East correspondent with our partners at Global Post. Generally, Laura, how is Egypt perceived these days as a tourist destination?
Well, in the last 4 years since the revolution in early 2011, in which longtime strongman Hosni Mubarak was ousted, things have not been good here on the tourism front. In 2014, the government estimated that tourism revenues were down 95%. And it's estimated that about 1 in 9 Egyptians work in the tourism industry. So it's affected a huge segment of the population.
And what about specifically Sharm el-Sheikh? Because it's been fairly violent-free, I understand, since the Arab Spring. Has it been immune to the problems in the rest of Egypt?
I wouldn't say immune, but the South Sinai resorts, including Sharm el-Sheikh, have been doing a little bit better than the rest of the country. There have still been package tours from Europe and from Russia that have been continuing to operate there.
I mean, we just heard from Moscow how popular Sharm el-Sheikh is with a lot of Russians. But generally, who are the tourists who go to Sharm el-Sheikh?
Generally, Russians, Europeans. In recent years, as tourism has been in decline, there have also been a lot of Egyptian tourists.
So just give us a sense of what's at stake for Egypt right now after the Arab Spring with the tourist dollar shrinking. I mean, what else do they have revenue-wise to bank on?
For a country of its size, with the level of poverty, actually, sort of in terms of petty crime, there's very little, but, you know, there are periodic attacks on security forces. In September, we saw a horrific event in which 8 Mexican tourists were killed in error by Egyptian security forces who were targeting militants in the area. There was a bus crash where 2 tourism buses collided in 2014. So there's sort of general unrest in the country. There's also an insurgency in North Sinai in which the ISIS affiliate here called the State of Sinai is battling security forces. So there is sort of general low-level unrest here while sort of petty crime is low.
So do you think that this plane crash is going to keep more people away from Egypt? And does Egypt have a plan to keep people coming?
I think it's likely that it will, at least in the short term. I mean, we're already seeing carriers like Lufthansa, Air France, and the Emirates avoiding flying over the Sinai Peninsula until the cause of the crash is determined. So, yes, I think it's likely that it will deter some people, unfortunately.
And what keeps people coming back to Sharm el-Sheikh, even when there is strife elsewhere in the region?
Well, for one thing, it's warm. For another, there are a lot of these hotels, restaurants, and so you have a beach sort of with all the amenities. And, you know, there's incredible diving off the Sinai Peninsula. And so, and as you say, it's been relatively insulated from the violence that has plagued the rest of the country.
Laura Dean, with our partners at Global Post, she's the senior Middle East correspondent there. Thanks a lot, Laura. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Indonesia has been called the smiling face of Islam. That's because the majority Muslim nation usually has a fairly moderate religious outlook. But Indonesia's smile doesn't seem so friendly lately, at least for some people in the LGBT community there. A new batch of laws just took effect in the province of Aceh, and those laws call for fines, jail time, and even beatings for those who engage in gay sex. Ruth Morris has our story.
Itja was born a boy, but the first time she put on a dress, she says she felt like a character out of a Barbie doll cartoon, Mariposa, the one with wings.
Itu yang kayak aku bilang seperti kayak dia Mariposa. Aku merasa ada jahat. Nggak tahu ya. Itu kalau misalnya di kartun-kartun tuh, ceng, kayak gimana sih? Kayak
she imagined a spotlight on her, and she felt,
wow, gitu loh.
Today, Itja works as a modeling coach and heads the local chapter of Violet Gray, an LGBT advocacy group in Aceh. She's wearing a floor-length pink dress, false eyelashes, and the traditional headscarf known as hijab. Not a wisp of hair is showing. Here in Aceh province, Muslim women have to wear the hijab. It's the law. But Itja wears it for another reason.
Jadi, Aku ingin juga yang pertama image dari transgender yang itu juga tidak.
It's respectable. People think transgender people are prostitutes, she says, and she wants to correct that.
Okay, kalau kamu memang perempuan, ya tampil.
There's another benefit. When she covers her head, she almost never gets called names. That's probably because Aceh is so religious. In a peace deal with separatists 10 years ago, the central government allowed Aceh to implement a version of Sharia law. Since then, the province has become increasingly conservative, so much so that Echa didn't want me to use her real name. On an evening drive through the capital, Banda Aceh, the coffee shops are brimming with young people on plastic chairs. There's no alcohol here, so coffee is king. Echa points out a hotel that used to be a hangout. No more. Then we pass the street Echa says used to be a hot spot, a meeting place for gay and transgender people. Tonight it's dark. The storefronts are shuttered.
We want good Muslim in Aceh.
Sharizal Abbas heads the local government's Islamic Sharia agency. He takes pains to stress that Aceh's version of Sharia law is gentle, moderate, nothing like the Sharia practiced by extremist groups in the Middle East and Africa.
ISIS, Boko Haram, very, very different.
But he's fully behind a new law that punishes gay relations with up to 100 strokes of the cane. Adultery carries the same penalty. Abbas explains how the law applies to gay couples.
Working together is no problem. Cooking in the kitchen, no problem. Sleeping in one room, one bed together is no problem.
The problem is if the couple engages in sex. In a narrow sense, it's more freedom than straight couples have here. Unmarried heterosexual couples can't ride a moped together or hold hands in public, but they can get married.
Ruang private dari teman-teman LGBT pasti.
It just says LGBT people feel their private space is being invaded. Before it was the public areas that were restricted. Now it's the bedroom too. At Echa's home, a roommate cooks noodles, and Echa tries to get everyone to eat. There's a row of lockers in the entryway. Her house is open to students, friends, and runaways. Some members of the LGBT community have left Aceh for Jakarta. Echa refuses to go. We have to stay strong, Echa says, and not expose ourselves. The important thing is to survive, even if we have to go further underground. She hopes the hijab will protect her. If a straight person sees a transgender person wearing hijab and respectful clothing, they'll feel more empathy, she says. We must go along with what is wanted. For The World, I'm Ruth Morris, Banda Aceh, Indonesia.
Ruth reported from Indonesia with help from the International Reporting Project. Coming up, America's drone program gets a makeover. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like marketing, meditation, and metalworking. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. How's this for excess baggage? An 1,800-pound rhinoceros on a plane. Yep, really, that happened this weekend. Veterinarians with the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden escorted a Sumatran rhino to a sanctuary in Indonesia. That's where it's hoped the male rhino will mate and help bring more Sumatran rhinos into the world. Dr. Monica Stoops is with the Center for Conservation and Research for Endangered Wildlife at the Cincinnati Zoo. And she didn't get to go with the rhino to Indonesia, but she knows him quite well.
We've heard from our staff that's over there at Waikambas National Park at the sanctuary, and they said he is doing fantastic. He arrived after a 30-hour plane ride, and then he had another day to get over to the sanctuary, and he did that by truck as well as by ferry.
Are there a lot of Sumatran rhinos there? Presumably a lot of female Sumatran rhinos?
Yeah, so in terms of the rhino dating game, he's got some good chances over there in Sumatra. They have three females that are located at the reserve, and there's one female in particular that they're hoping that he's got his eye for. Her name is Rosa. The reserve itself is located within the Wycombus National Park. So it's within a national park system.
Why do the scientists believe Rosa is the one for him?
Well, Harapan, or Harry, his brother, Andalas, arrived at the sanctuary back in 2007. And so Andalas already has a lady over there by the name of Ratu, and he has sired a calf. And Ratu also has another one that's expected on the way in May. And so Rosa is the only eligible lady of similar age. We think they're going to be a good pair. They're both kind of spunky and feisty.
The point of this is to promote breeding. How endangered are the Sumatran rhinos?
Sumatran rhinos are critically endangered. There's estimated to be less than 100 individual Sumatran rhinos worldwide. There's a small captive population on Borneo, consists of three individuals. And then the Sumatran Rhino Sanctuary, of course, has a semi-captive situation with the animals there. The rest of the rhinos are free-ranging, located within different park systems throughout Indonesia.
The Cincinnati Zoo has kind of been at the forefront of rescuing these endangered rhinos. You already mentioned a couple of them.
Yeah, Cincinnati Zoo, we're not known as the sexiest zoo for nothing. And that comes along with the fact that there's been three Sumatran rhino calves born here at Cincinnati, which was a first of its kind since over 100 years.
I've been reading that Indonesia is on fire right now. Not enough rain, a lot of drought, slash and burn agriculture all over Southeast Asia. Will Harry be safe in the smoke and haze?
Harry will be. He is in one of the nicest reserves that are over there in Wycombus. So it's located on the island of Sumatra itself. In addition, International Rhino Foundation supports rhino protection units. So those individuals are also over there to protect the rhinos in the national parks.
So how are you going to know if this relocation project is actually working?
Harry's success will be measured, one, by what's already happened. He's gotten over there successfully. He's adapting well already in the local browse, and I'm sure he's taking a good mud wallow right now, stretching his legs after that long flight, getting used to ranging out into the forest and eating the local browse that's there. And then, of course, meeting with Rosa when it comes time. And the staff over there are fully trained in using ultrasound to be able to know when those females are ready to breed. So they will pick the right time and bring those two rhinos together. And hopefully there'll be some rhino magic going on.
Harapan, his Indonesian name, what does that mean?
Harapan actually means hope. So we do have hope
no
for
kidding.
Harry.
Perfect. Dr. Monica Stoops with the Cincinnati Zoo, thank you very much. Good luck to you and to Harry.
Thanks so much. Pregnant thoughts.
You've probably heard about the Predator and the Reaper. Those are the names of the unmanned aerial vehicles that fly combat missions overseas. These so-called drones are operated by two-person ground crews based at Creech Air Force Base just outside Las Vegas. A pilot steers the aircraft, while a sensor operator watches video feeds from the drone wherever it's flying. The team is in what's called a cockpit, but it's not exactly like being in a fighter jet.
It looks like a desk, like an office desk with a bank of monitors and, you know, a keyboard that, you know, is stuffed into, you know, a trailer that's air conditioned and is light and so forth. But that's what it looks like.
Stephen Trimble is a reporter for Flight Global. He's been covering the story of the Air Force drone program.
You know, it's an intense operation. There's not many of these aircraft, relatively speaking. They're needed constantly. They fly them in 24-hour, 7-day-a-week surveillance orbits. And that requires this constant rotation of crews.
You say not many of these aircraft. How many are there? And just remind us where Predator and Reaper drones are flying for the most part right now.
Well, there's a few hundred in the fleet, a portion of those that are based stateside for training. There's a contingent in Afghanistan and in Southwest Asia, the Arabian Peninsula, parts of Africa. And the rest of it, you sort of have to guess where they might be.
So this proposal that Lieutenant General Robert Otto, head of intelligence and surveillance for the Air Force, he made this proposal last week. What is it?
Well, what he's saying is that they need to start saving money when it comes to operating these aircraft. And the easiest way to do that is to reduce the amount of manpower. And one way to do that is to, instead of having a two-person cockpit, you would have a one-person cockpit. And obviously, you reduce your manpower cost of that operation by half. But that requires developing a new kind of cockpit that is designed or architected for a single pilot to operate all the sensor information, all the weapons, and the aircraft itself.
So if the control panel for these drones goes through this redesign, are you saying that basically any Air Force pilot could operate it?
Yes, any trained pilot, combat or otherwise, would be able to operate this kind of cockpit. That would be the idea. And it would be set up to be actually very familiar to many of them, especially if they've come from, say, the F-16 community, which already does this kind of mission with a single pilot.
For Top Guns, I mean, there is a lot of glory with flying a jet. Do you think people in, you think personnel in the military are just going to say, yeah, I'll go sit at a desk for a while?
Yeah, that's been a whole issue about it. How do you attract pilots, some of them who, you know, wanted to fly F-16s or F-15s, which, you know, just have to be a lot more fun than sitting in a trailer at a desk. But there are people who really do just enjoy this part of it. And it's interesting, if you look at other militaries and other services, you look at the way the Army manages its fleet of aircraft, which are very similar to the Predator and the Reaper. They don't use operational commissioned officers and trained pilots. They use warrant officers or enlisted personnel. And, you know, that saves them a lot of money because they're not devoting all those resources to training these people.
We've heard a lot about burnout of drone operators. Do you think this is going to change the burnout factor at all?
No, I can't see how it would have a direct impact on that. I mean, there's other factors. Part of it's the irregularity of the operations and how that affects sleep cycles and how it affects their morale overall. Just even the disconnected nature of the operations sometimes takes a toll on people. And there's also been the question throughout this whole program about how these officers, you know, what kind of career track they're on. And those issues aren't really directly impacted by something like this. But if they design the cockpit right, it shouldn't add to their stress level. In fact, it could reduce the amount of stress that they're dealing with.
Reporter Stephen Trimble, thanks very much for telling us about this.
Oh, no problem. Glad to help.
You are listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Many Indian women inherit their mother's saris, but they don't wear them because they look dated. Until this woman breathes new life into those clothes.
Hundreds of women are wearing pieces of hundreds of other women's things in their saris, and that, you know, it's fun, huh?
And that's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International and by Soundworks.org, offering perspectives on events and cultures around the globe with The World's Daily Podcast and the Studio 360 Podcast. Subscribe at Soundworks.org or iTunes.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has plenty of reasons to celebrate today. His Justice and Development Party, known as the AKP, regained a parliamentary majority in yesterday's elections in Turkey. After the victory, Erdogan said, "The whole world must show respect." Now, that remark was aimed at some in the Western media who've been critical of Erdogan and his policies. Here to help me make sense of Erdogan's big victory is Borzu Daragahi. He's been covering the election in Turkey for BuzzFeed. This was an election that for Americans, Borzu, may have seemed distant, but Turkish-American relations are crucial, especially right now. So a victorious Erdogan, was this a surprise victory?
No one expected this type of victory for Erdogan and his party. Erdogan made a number of gambles, really, really serious gambles, serious bets in the last few months, risking really huge things, including the security of the country, and he appears to have won big.
So apparently Erdogan's bets have paid off. This new majority has apparently allows him to basically pass any measures he wants. Kind of reminds me of George W. Bush, his line, "I've got political capital, I'm going to spend it." What does Erdogan plan to do with his power?
Well, that remains to be seen. He did not get enough seats in the parliament to do what he really wants, is to reshape the Turkish government from a parliamentary coalition government style system into a strong presidential system like that in the U.S. or in France. He did not get enough to do that, to change the constitution without any other coalition partners. So that's going to be interesting to see whether he continues to try to pursue that ambition of his.
Borzu, is there even an opposition now on this morning after this election to Erdogan and his party? Is there anything resembling an opposition? And what does that say about the health of democracy today in Turkey?
Well, I think there is an opposition. I mean, the AK party barely got 50% of the vote. It was just a little bit under 50%. So a majority of Turks voted against Erdogan's party, but they're just divided, you know. And so you do have opposition. You do have the activists who were part of the Gezi Park movement a couple years ago. They're still out there. They're still angry about where the country is heading. So I think it's out there. And if you're here on the streets of Istanbul or any of the other cities here, it doesn't feel like, you know, Erdogan is a Putin-like presence. People still make fun of him. People still deride him. So, you know, there is opposition. It's just that they're going to have to work through another way other than the institutions of higher power, which are now dominated mostly by Erdogan's party and his allies.
What does all this kind of imply for the U.S. and for the region?
One little interesting note that we should put, the one implication for this election that's positive in many respects. Erdogan and his Justice and Development Party have been very, very, very welcoming toward the 2 million plus Syrian refugees that are in Turkey right now. They've sought to accommodate them, provide them with humanitarian supplies, provide them even with the means to go to school and so on. This created a lot of resentment among some more nationalist Turks. And if Erdogan would have lost, the policy on the Syrian refugees might have changed. And this is probably a net positive for the West that Turkey is willing to take so many of these refugees, because if they were really mistreated here, they would probably head to the West in even greater numbers than they are right now. But the fact that Erdogan, because of various reasons, you know, somewhat ideologically, as well as the sort of way he fashions himself as a sort of leader of the Muslim world, because of that, you'll probably see a continued accommodation of these Syrian refugees.
As far as just kind of immediate effects on the war in Syria, aside from assistance perhaps for the refugees, what do you see the outcome of this election doing?
Well, you will see Turkey take a more active role, a more public role in supporting the Syrian rebels and providing them with weapons as they fight against Bashar al-Assad, maybe becoming as strident as Saudi Arabia is right now in providing support for the Syrian rebels.
Borzu Dargahi, who is in Turkey covering the elections there for BuzzFeed. Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Syrians are part of what's being called the single largest human migration since World War II. I'm referring, of course, to the massive arrival of migrants into Europe. Well, some good news now on that front that I want to pass along. The International Olympic Committee has announced that refugee athletes will be able to compete under the Olympic flag at next year's Summer Games in Brazil. Gore Maker competed under that Olympic flag 3 years ago. He's a marathon runner from South Sudan. In 2012, the newly formed country had not yet been recognized by the IOC, and running for Sudan, the country South Sudan broke away from, was not something Maker would do. So he ran in the London Games as an independent Olympic athlete. Maker hails the IOC decision as a way to give young athletes hope.
These youth, wherever they might be and whoever they are, if they have ability to qualify, then now they would have no fear of saying, I cannot go to the Olympic even though I'm good. But now they are going to say, I can go to the Olympic. Now all I need to do is to work hard and be able to qualify. So it's give them hope and inspire them. And that's, I hope that's how they are feeling. And that's where I was feeling in 2012.
Yeah, you had to fight, though, to compete under the flag, the Olympic flag in 2012 as an independent athlete. Do you think your appeal to the IOC may have actually helped its current policy to athletes who don't have a home or ones who don't want to participate for a country they fled from?
I would not take that as credit to me. I don't look at it saying, oh, my case that happened in 2012, that might allow the IOC to make the decision. I wouldn't think that has in case. I think the IOC just realized, and the time is different. 2012 was a different time. And now we are going to go to 2016. It's going to be a different time.
Are you worried that with the refugee population just growing across the globe, that no matter how hard the IOC includes people like you, other refugees, there are probably many young, talented athletes out there who will just slip into the shadows, never to be recognized?
Yes, I am. I am worried, and I hope that this will not continue for long. It's very painful. And, you know, something called war. is damaged. Damaged the human population, is damaged the talent. Like right now in all across the Middle East, in Africa, all these young talent who are supposed to be in the school, doing a sport and all of this, it's going to go chaos. We're going to lose them, and that is how the talent's going to go away. So they're going to go to somewhere they're not supposed to. And that's why you see IOC coming to this, to step in, to try to say, we can do something. We can do our part and let the world leader do their part by bringing peace into the country. So the IOC is bringing peace to the refugee community by giving the youth a hope.
Right. I mean, athletes would still need to qualify like any athlete, but it sounds like this new policy from the IOC is a new dose of hope.
It is a new dose of hope. And now it's going to depend. That's what I said earlier. Now it's going to depend on the youth and wherever they are to say, okay, now there is opportunity. I'm eligible to go to the Olympic. Now it depends. It's up to me to work hard, because IOC, there is a standard. Standard qualify. Every athlete must meet those standards in whichever event they wanted to perform in. So those guidance, they are going to determine the qualification of any refugees or any athlete who may want to go to Olympic in 2016.
So, Gore, even though you now participate for South Sudan, will some part of you cheer the refugee athletes, even if, say, one of them takes the gold from one of your countrymen?
My heart is always with refugees worldwide. I will be with refugees for the rest of my life to think about them and to acknowledge them. And hopefully I would get a chance to be able to work to help the refugees in some point. I would be great, and it would be really a good thing to see refugees who qualify, make it to the Olympic, and win some medals. I will support them, yes.
South Sudanese and refugee marathon runner, Gore Maker, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
This next story is about reinventing an old favorite. Across India, the sari is the traditional outfit for women. It's a one-size-fits-all piece of clothing, 18 feet of fabric, artfully draped. But these days, a lot of young Indian women don't wear saris, though they still tend to own one or two tucked away in their closets. That was the case for reporter Chavi Sachdev. Here's her story of what to do with a tradition you want to hold on to, even if the look doesn't quite work for you.
The first time I ever wore a sari, I was a senior in college. It was my mom's sari. It was navy blue with a really big green and gold border. And this was in the days before you could just go on YouTube to find out how to put one on.
Take the sari around you twice. We will come back to the pleats, which is step two. We now will address the pallu and the pallu length.
It took me so many attempts to get it right. We're talking 18 feet of fabric that you have to pleat so it falls like a skirt. Then you have to get the pallu that drapes across your torso and left shoulder to stay the right length. And you have to be careful not to unravel it all by stepping on the hem. So wearing it is really hard work, and keeping it on is even harder. These days, most young women who live in cities prefer to wear Western clothing. Saris are old-fashioned and they're not sexy.
I'm Ramya. I'm 18. I've only seen my mom's saris and my whole family's saris, and I don't really like any of them because they have this sign of their age.
I'm Shrushti. I'm 17, turning on 18.
Yes, I've worn them, but I don't like them so much because they're cotton and somehow I look too fat in that.
I'm Revati. I am 18. I love my grandma's saris as well, but I wouldn't wear them. I wouldn't wear them because I don't think they're me.
Okay, but in most of India, wearing a sari is the norm. My grandmothers wore them every day. They cooked, slept, biked to college, worked, raised 4 kids each in a sari. And when they died, I was honored to inherit saris from both my grandmothers. They are my legacy. They're the only tangible remembrance I have of either of them. But these saris never see the light of day. They're safe in my closet. So I've decided to do something about that. I've come to meet Deepa Mehta, who runs a sari store called Queen of Hearts. Deepa also does something unusual. She repurposes old saris.
I make it for the girls who are just starting. That's my muse. My daughter's my muse. Girls in their 20s are my muse.
Deepa takes traditional saris in cotton or silk, and then she jazzes them up. On her bright green sari, she's embroidered fluorescent fish. Others have got owls or block-printed umbrellas. There's even a deck of cards.
I love playing cards. When I was playing solitaire, therefore Queen of Hearts, you know. So there's no... It was all just what was there. There was no plan, thinking.
It all started when her daughter needed to borrow one of her saris, but...
She said, I will not wear it if it looks like a mamma sari. So I had to make it a young sari, the same saris. Just make it something that I will wear.
And that's why I'm here. I've brought along the only thing I have from my paternal grandmother, who died before I was born. It's a silk sari with an exquisite border made from real silver thread. But it's a ghastly pistachio green, and I've never worn it, mostly because I'd have to be about 65 to carry it off. It's been in my closet forever, and with saris, if you don't wear them, they fall apart. And I don't want that to happen, because this sari, like all saris, has a story, and I don't want that story to disappear. So Deepa talks to me about how I can hold on to this legacy, but make it my own.
I'll take a magenta pink, something that has body, and then I'll transfer this on that. So magenta and this color will look nice together.
I have to say, I'm impressed. I would never have thought of cannibalizing the best parts of the sari to make something fresh from it.
Hundreds of women are wearing pieces of hundreds of other women's things in their saris, and their, you know, it's fun, huh?
And then she says something else that resonates with me.
Saris are emotional, no?
That part I agree with. My favorites are still the ones my mother and my grandmothers gave me. Loved, worn, and passed down like treasured family jewels. For The World, I'm Chavi Sachdev, Mumbai.
Before we take a short break, a look at a story we'll have tomorrow on The World. It's about community policing in Rio de Janeiro's poorest neighborhoods, the favelas.
When you talk to people in the favelas, they want, you know, a police which is there to support them and to try to make the territory safe.
But many of Rio's favelas have not been safe. And now, a year ahead of the Olympics, authorities are desperate to pacify those neighborhoods. But drug violence may be worse than ever. Bystanders are often injured and killed in shootouts between drug dealers and the police. One such war went on for 100 days.
I think we should have never started this war on drugs. I think it was a huge mistake with huge costs. When it's finally over, one day we will look back and we will wonder how it was possible that people devise those policies.
And favela residents are really angry now after video emerged of Rio police shooting a young man, then planting a gun on his lifeless body. That story is coming up tomorrow. Just ahead, Doppel Your Fun with a doppelganger. You're listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let's talk Mexican liquor, and no, not tequila. Mezcal, call it tequila's intriguing cousin. Like tequila, mezcal is made from the agave plant, and demand for it is booming. Mezcal production is way up, and that means big changes for the Mexican villages where it's made. There's also a twist to this tale, and I don't mean a twist of lemon. Grace Rubenstein has our story.
Mezcal is a key ingredient at the Devil's Acre Bar in San Francisco. Patrons pay up to $29 a shot for the rarest kind. They know it's strong and smoky. A masculine kind of drink. What most don't know is that some of the people who make that liquor are probably women. And Graciela Angeles is one of the most respected among them.
De colores es el arco iris que vemos lucir.
Graciela Angeles walks with her young son from their house to the mezcal distillery she runs, Real Minero. It's in a rural town in Oaxaca, southern Mexico. Angeles is the fourth generation of mezcal makers in her family, and she's kind of a revolutionary, a woman armed with a master's degree who's grown Real Minero from a small family project into a high-end brand.
En la familia siempre han participado las mujeres y los hombres.
Angeles says women have always been part of making mezcal. Women have long tended the ovens that cook the agave plant. They've also filled the bottles, fed the workers, managed the finances.
Pero finalmente así esa mujer chaparrita menudita
Angeles explains how, during Mexico's prohibition, women like her great-grandmother clandestinely carried jugs of mezcal for miles to sell in neighboring towns. But it was always the men who got the credit. Now with mezcal becoming a global hit, more women are stepping into the spotlight. 40 minutes south, in the remote town of Mihuatlan, Reina Sanchez is a different kind of mezcalera, as the female mezcal makers are called. She's a bit rowdy.
Ah, era licor bendito, santo alimento. ¿Qué haces afuera? Vamos para adentro.
Sanchez runs a one-woman shop and crushes the tough agave fibers by hand. She beats the fibers with a wooden mallet until her shoulders burn. Unlike Graciela Angeles, Sanchez has very little education. And unlike Real Minero, she has no brand name, no labels, not even bottles. She keeps her product in plastic barrels inside her house, equipped with spigots. Yet Sanchez is known regionally for making some of the best mezcal around. I ask her what it's like to be a woman making mezcal, but the question seems irrelevant. She says she makes mezcal because she needs to. It's either that or migrate to the United States. But there's still a long way until women have a high profile in the mezcal industry. Among the hundreds of people at a recent national meeting of mezcal makers, only 5 were women. Even Graciela Angeles's own father struggled to accept that his daughter, not one of his sons, would run the family business.
Porque el tema es cómo jalas a todas las demás, cómo las activas.
Angeles says a big challenge is bringing along a new generation of women, convincing them of what they can achieve. But there's one other important group of women in mezcal who should not be overlooked. Consumers.
Porque además las mujeres somos muy buenas bebedoras de mezcal, de verdad.
That's Berenice Muñiz, who co-founded the popular mezcal brands Ocho Víboras and Diestro y Siniestro. She says women are some of the savviest drinkers. I can vouch for that. Back at Real Minero in Oaxaca, Graciela Angeles opens a bottle of her mezcal. It's made with one of the fieriest tasting agaves. We're all women drinking here, Mexican and American, including my mom. Angeles says, with this mezcal, my mom will sleep like an angel. For the world, I'm Grace Rubenstein, Oaxaca, Mexico.
You'll find photos of Mexico's mezcaleras at PRI.org. Too much mezcal and you'll be seeing double. Neil Thomas Douglas was stone cold sober when he boarded a plane only to see himself already seated.
At first, it took me back a little bit and then just burst out laughing.
Douglas was on a flight to Galway, Ireland, last Thursday and was seated, completely by chance, next to his doppelganger. Same red hair, same ginger beard, and it didn't stop there.
There's lots of ginger guys with big beards in Scotland, you know, but it's the facial features, and a dentist tweeted me saying that it's actually the teeth as well, which is very bizarre.
A photo of the two men on the plane went viral, but it gets better. Douglas and his doppelganger from London share similar tastes as well.
Well, what happened when we got off the flight, I went into the hotel where I was staying, and he was actually staying in the same hotel as me. Then I went out to sample Galway's nightlife, and the first bar I went into, he was there. So we had a pint and a laugh about it, you know.
Crazy when you think about it. And the story got me thinking about doppelgangers and where the notion comes from that somewhere on Earth we all have body doubles. And who better to ask than the world's Chris Wolfe? Chris, you're our history guy. We've got 2 minutes. Tell me about doppelgangers.
Well, Marco, you're talking about it as the kind of conventional meaning that most people think of now as someone who's not related to you who looks exactly like you, which is probably an accident of genetics. But there is a much deeper, older meaning in many cultures around the world, from ancient Egypt through most of the Celtic cultures of... When you see yourself, it's kind of a real harbinger of bad luck or even death, this kind of first-comer phenomenon, as it's called in so many cultures. It's been used in literature, too, to explore the duality of human nature, like in Edgar Allan Poe and Goethe and lots of Scottish stories. So that's the doppelgangers. And, you know, there could be some basis in this mysterious evil twist because there's a medical phenomenon of seeing yourself in some people with epilepsy and schizophrenia.
Are there famous doppelgangers in history that are worth mentioning?
Absolutely. It's pretty well known that Adolf Hitler and Stalin both had stand-ins because they were worried about getting assassinated or they wanted to spread their presence around. The British, actually, there's a famous, you know, the British equivalent of Patton was this guy called Bernard Montgomery in World War II. And David Niven was working for the army and hired this actor who looked like him to go on a tour of the Mediterranean to try and confuse the Nazis about where the Allied invasion of Europe was going to be. And that was all very well documented. And then, of course, who could forget History of the World Part 1, where the King of France is famously doubled up with Jacques, the guy who runs the pee bucket.
Finally, why do we describe this spitting image of ourselves in German, doppelganger? Where does that kind of word come from?
Well, it means double walker or double goer, literally. And it was coined in 1796 in a novel by a German writer to mean that kind of spiritual harbinger of doom kind of character. The English actually had a word for something similar, which was called a fetch. And then doppelganger first moves into English in about the mid-19th century as kind of the word for that thing, and then kind of morphs into the body double type.
I knew we would get the answer, plus more answers from the world's Chris Wolf. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Marco.
And that is all from us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, or as my body double would say, here at WGBH in Boston. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Rose Family Fund, by the United States Japan Foundation, the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation working to build a world where nuclear weapons will never be used again, by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brandon Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.